Sunshine right now, easterly winds at 15, 35 in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This beautiful music is by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. It is his overture to the Song of Hiawatha. And this is just one of the noteworthy works that will be played on the next concert of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, coming up on the 5th of April. And I'm very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with David Anderson, music director of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, about what is in store for this upcoming concert. David Anderson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's great to be back.
So I have to say that as I looked at this concert order for this upcoming concert, I found it very enticing. Each and every piece of music was really appealing in various ways. A couple of them beloved favorites, couple of things not nearly so well known, and certainly this piece with which I believe the concert will open is quite a lovely piece, though that most people have never heard probably in their concert going lives. Tell us a little bit about what prompted you to program this overture to the Song of Hiawatha by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, and maybe a word about this intriguing composer.
Sure. This is a beautiful piece of music, as you just played for the audience here. I had discovered it through a colleague of mine in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, James Blatchley. He programmed it with them, and I attended the concert, and it was just this beautiful piece. And I was like, oh my goodness, how have I never heard of this work before? And so I'm like, well, at some point I'm going to do it with Lake Geneva Symphony. So this was a great opportunity to do so. Coleridge Taylor, he was a British composer in the late 1800s. And this overture to the Song of Hiawatha is probably the most famous selection that came out of this set of three cantatas that he composed based on an epic poem by 19th century American poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And like I said, the overture is an absolutely gorgeous piece, and it's probably the one that's most famous from this collection.
I thought it would be fun to hear just a little bit more from it, but first I wanted to hear what kind of a challenge it is for you to give this to your orchestra, a piece that I would assume none of them have ever played before, and probably most of them had never even heard it before.
Yeah, that is true, and so there is the lack of familiarity. However, you know, once you hear a piece like that, and you hear it more and you hear it more, and you want to play it more and you want to play it well. Interestingly, I think one of the big challenges has to do with I guess the key choices that Coleridge Taylor provides to the musicians. You know, sometimes if you play in like the key of C or the key of F or the key of G, you know, with like very, you know, very little accidentals in the key signature, they can be, you know, easier, but he provides us maybe five sharps or five flats in the key signature for some of the instruments, and it just poses technical challenges. We of course can get, you know, can overcome those challenges, but you know, especially on the initial readings of it takes some getting used to.
Right. But boy, it's worth it because this piece, as you said, is so incredibly gorgeous. We're going to hear just a little bit of the very exciting concluding measures of the Hiawatha Overture of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. That's from a Marco Polo compact disc of the Overture to the Song of Hiawatha by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. It's going to open the next concert of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra on April 5th. You are also going to be featuring on that program your orchestra's Young Artist Competition winner, Aurelia Meyer. Tell us just a little bit about the competition itself and about this young cellist who will be performing with the orchestra.
Well, we have a young artist competition every May, and we've done that for the last several years. And the idea is that the young artists in the region, they compete, they do a concerto competition, and we have an outside adjudicator, and they select the best one, and it comes with a $750 scholarship to be used for for further music study that's given by the Lake Geneva Rotary Club and the Neil Heffernan family. And also, an option comes with that is to play with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra in the future season. And so Aurelia Meyer from Janesville, she was a senior in high school last year, and she won the concerto competition. And so this is why she receives this honor right now. And it's really interesting because we, in the past few years, we've also done this fellows program with the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, where we collaborate with them with their string program to provide some scholarships for students to play in the symphony. And as luck would have it, Aurelia chose Whitewater to attend as a music major, and she happened to also win the honor of being a fellow. And so for the first time in our history, we have these two sort of educational initiatives that have overlapped. Our young artist competition winner from the previous year is now a freshman at Whitewater, so she is a fellow and she is also the concerto winner. So it's a really unique thing.
Very good. And although I don't have a recording handy, I love this cello concerto in C major by Haydn, and I suspect it is a lovely showcase for this young cellist.
It's a perfect piece. It is a masterpiece. It's just really bright and sunny, and it's just, a lot of fun to listen to. And Aurelia is doing a really, really nice job.
Wonderful. Well, speaking of young musicians, I know young musicians are going to be involved in the playing of the next work, which is on the program, and that is the beloved Finlandia by Finnish composer Jan Sibelius. Tell us about the way in which this will be performed, or maybe the way in which it will be played and by whom.
We're going to add 37 string players from around the region, different high schools around the region. We have seven represented, people from the Badger High School and their school district in Delavan-Darien, Fort Atkinson, Elkhorn, Antioch, Woodstock, and Kenosha. We're going to have students from all of those schools. A few of them have already been rehearsing with us on our regular Thursday evening rehearsals, and then when we have our concert week rehearsals, we're going to add all of them. And so there's going to be over 100 musicians on the Badger High School stage on this, and so we're really excited to welcome them. Chance to for students to have a chance to play with the really large orchestra and this really amazing piece of music that I think everybody should be able to play at some point in their lives if they are an orchestral musician. And so to play it when you're in high school is a really cool thing.
Absolutely. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard Sibelius's Finlandia. Is there anything you want to say about the work itself and its place in the canon?
Well, it's one of those pieces. It's easily recognized at a point in the music, even if there's somebody who's like not a fan of orchestral music. You might listen in the audience to the first part and think, "Oh, wow, this is a really cool piece. I don't think I've ever heard this before." And then about two-thirds of the way through, there's a hymn tune, and the hymn tune is frequently known as "Be Still, My Soul," and Sibelius was he's the composer of this, and it existed first in this tone poem, and then it's become sort of the unofficial national anthem of Finland. And because of that, this tune has been adapted in various ways in various hymn books since it was composed over 100 years ago. And so that certainly would be familiar to many in our audience.
Right. By the happiest of coincidences, the church choir I conduct this past Sunday sang Finlandia with a couple of different texts.
Great.
And so I've had this amazing main melody ringing in my ears for that reason. So this is something that people can look forward to, that is hearing the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra play Sibelius's Finlandia side by side with area young string players. Here's the closing measures. The stirring finale to Sibelius's wonderful tone poem, Finlandia. And as if all that weren't enough, you are finishing out the program with a very stirring symphony by one Felix Mendelssohn. Tell our listeners about the work that will serve as the concert's finale.
Well, this is known as the Reformation Symphony, and we were mentioning the hymn tune, the Sibelius hymn tune, and so this was composed by Sibelius, and it became a hymn tune. And Mendelssohn kind of did the opposite. He was going to compose this symphony, and he was thinking it was going to commemorate the 300th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession in Germany. It was going to be June of 1830. So he started writing this piece. He was never actually officially asked to write this piece for this event, but he was like, well, that would be kind of nice if maybe it would be selected for these celebrations, but never was, and he kind of delayed on his composition, and so it never, this was never part of. Was the Reformation and Lutheranism, and so if you're going to write a piece and celebrate the Reformation, what hymn would you choose to use? And so Mendelssohn chose "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," which was composed by Martin Luther, hundreds of years before. And so that's how the fourth movement opens, is with this particular hymn tune. And it makes strategic appearances throughout the fourth movement. But when you look at sort of the whole work in totality, especially the outer movements, the first and the fourth movement, it's kind of like a battle, a battle between the Catholicism and Lutheranism. And so he will even do things like he will start composing in the style of Catholic composer, Palestrina, the opening of the first movement, and then that kind of gets shoved to the side in favor of this other style of music. And so it's just a really fascinating kind of musical battle that Mendelssohn is utilizing in this particular work. It makes for some great drama and some great music as well.
Wonderful. And that will certainly be an exciting way to bring this evening's concert to a close. Again, we're talking about the next concert of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, Saturday, April 5th at Badger High School. If people are interested in attending Saturday night's concert, what should they do?
You can go to the website, lakegenevaorchestra.org. We also will have some tickets at the door if we still have any left. We also have a Facebook page. So we're really, really excited about this performance and hope that everyone is able to attend.
Very good. And on the podium, David Anderson, music director of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Good to talk with you once again, Maestro. Best wishes to you and your musicians.
Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it.
And to finish out this portion of WGTD's morning show, let's hear the magnificent conclusion to the Symphony No. 5 in D minor, known affectionately as the Reformation Symphony, Opus 107, by Felix Mendelssohn. This is a Vox compact disc featuring the Rochester Philharmonic under the direction of David Zinman. And again, this will be the finale for the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra for their concert coming up this Saturday evening at Badger High School. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're replaying a morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. I am exceptionally excited to be talking for the next few minutes with author Andre Cherny, an editor for the idea journal Democracy, and the author of an extraordinary new book about an extraordinary moment of the 20th century. The book is called The Candy Bombers, and you probably need to read the subtitle in order to know exactly what this story is about. The untold story of the Berlin airlift and America's finest hour. In it, we hear of the besieged city of Berlin in 1948 and 1949, and of the incredible undertaking by the Americans to airlift desperately needed supplies into that besieged, blockaded city. It is an incredible story, inspiring, and there are also darker shadows to the story, a very complicated story, which in the end helps us appreciate all the more that this undertaking was accomplished as well as it was. And we have Andre Cherny with us for the next few minutes to talk about his book, again called The Candy Bombers. Andre Cherny, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, good morning to you and all your listeners.
I think it is especially intriguing that you end the title of the book, America's Finest Hour. And you actually speak quite persuasively in the book about how, in many respects, you consider this to be a sort of summit moment for America. Tell us more about what you mean.
Well, as you described, this is really the perhaps the moment of greatest unalloyed goodness in American history. Here was the German people who we had, of course, defeated in a very bitter conflict, World War II, a few years later. And we took this enormous undertaking to basically feed and supply the residents of Hitler's capital to make sure that they were able to live and not starve to death. That is the kind of thing that America, perhaps only in the world, of the nations of the world, can do, and this was really a representation of what America should be about in the world.
Hmm. You said it was a turning point in the nation's history, the moment America came to fully accept the mantle of leader of the free world. But it was more than that. It was the moment when America became beloved by the very people it had defeated in battle and whose cities it had leveled, and was revered by people around the world who looked to the United States as a source of decency and good. You also say that although this is a story of America at her best, those are your words, you say it is by no means a simple story or a straight line. Tell us why this is a more complicated story than we might at first recall or believe.
Well, sometimes these things get reduced to a sentence or a paragraph in high school history books or even many of the other histories of this era that have been written. But it was, of course, was not a simple story, and in my estimation, that makes it something even more inspiring. This was a decision that was a very difficult decision. When Berlin was blockaded, of course, this was an island of Western Berlin that was surrounded by Soviet territory, and American forces were hopelessly outnumbered, 60-1. And the decision had to be made about what would happen. The main general on the ground thought we should send an armed convoy through the blockade, something that people then thought, and we now know, looking at Soviet archives, would have begun World War III. In fact, most of the advisors in Harry Truman's administration, his top generals and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or his top cabinet officials, thought we should abandon Berlin. And the decision to make the Berlin airlift was something we really fell into backwards. We thought, let's send a few planes over into Berlin to try to augment their supplies in a small way. And those few planes stretched out for a couple of days, and then we did it for a couple of weeks, and then months, and eventually we were able to do it for a whole year. But it was not something that we went into knowing really what we were doing. And all these people in the book, whether they're people like Harry Truman, whether they're people who are unknown today, they're complicated characters, and they make their mistakes in the book, as the readers will see. But in some ways, as I said before, that's what makes it so inspiring, because they weren't these great people we put on a pedestal. They were human just like the rest of us, and yet they figured out how to, at that moment that it mattered most, combine America's military and its moral might in a way that had people all over the world believing that America was the country they should emulate and admire.
Hmm. You list in the introduction to the book some of the pivotal figures, beginning with this accidental president, Harry Truman, James Forrestal, Secretary of Defense, Bill Tunner, a military organizer, Lucius Clay, a general stationed in Berlin, and the most famous of the pilots, Hal Halvorsen. You said it was these unlikely men who improvised and stumbled their way into inventing a uniquely American approach to the world that, to echo what you just said, married the nation's military and moral might. I mean, it's interesting when we hear terms like improvising and stumbling to describe something which ultimately was a great success.
Sounds familiar.
It sure does, doesn't it? You begin your book, the first chapter is called The Banks. And I think some people will be, I think, pleasantly surprised, as I was, that in a book about the Berlin airlift, you actually begin your book in the spring of 1945. Explain to our listeners why this section of the book is called The Banks.
Well, the book is divided up into three sections, and each have a river kind of theme, the banks, and then there's the bend, and at the end there's the bridge. But this book is called The Banks because it starts off right at the River Elbe, which is the dividing river between Germany west and east, and that was the place that Soviet and American troops linked up at the very, very end of World War II. The Soviets, of course, coming from the east, battling back the Nazi forces, the American troops coming from the west, from D-Day and Normandy onwards. And this was the moment that these two great armies met, and they met in a spirit of great friendship.
But you say the war was not yet over, and the bliss on the Elbe was premature. And, of course, it was probably premature in more than one respect. I mean, not only was World War II actually not officially concluded, but you're probably also alluding to the fact that the Americans and Soviets would very soon find themselves very seriously at odds with one another.
As this occupation of Germany developed and Germany was divided four ways, with each of the big powers of World War II getting its part, these countries were pushing up against one another, especially the United States and the Soviet Union. And they, of course, had different visions of the world. The Soviets started one after another toppling the governments of Eastern Europe, Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and the rest. And all that took place between the end of World War II and when this events that are mostly described in this book begin in 1948. And, of course, West Berlin was the next piece of free territory as the Soviet threat in the minds of many Americans was heading west. And they thought if we don't take a stand there, if we let Berlin fall, then Germany will be next, and soon after will be France and Italy. And in the same way that Hitler had captured all of Europe, the Soviets will do the very same.
Hmm. In this portion of the book, you talk for a while, at some length, about President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, of course, is soon to die, and his attitudes towards Germany and what he believed had been the great mistake at the end of World War I. And his attitude is contrary to that which we hear from many historians and analysts, that the big problem at the end of World War I was that Germany was economically brought to its knees, and out of that savage period of difficulty arose all this anger and resentment, which eventually blossomed into the Third Reich and so on. Franklin Roosevelt believed a very different sort of mistake had been made regarding the Allies and Germany. Explain what his attitude was.
Well, it was really not just his attitude, but the attitude of a lot of Americans, that they believed we had not been harsh enough. They believed that we had let the Germans off easy. And there was a big debate heading into the occupation of Germany, and even in the first years of the occupation of Germany, about how do we change a country. It's a debate that has some resonance for us today, of course, in our current circumstances. But how do you change a country? How do you bring democracy to a country? There was a sense that there was, as Roosevelt put it, a cancer at the very heart of the German people, at the heart of their culture, that made them susceptible to Nazism and other forms of authoritarianism. There was the Prussian influence and things like that that made them very martial and made them believe that democracy and freedom were not the right way to go. And in American powers, in American officials, among American officials, there was this big discussion about, do we get rid of this cancer through harshness, or do we do it by economic incentives, by helping the German people succeed economically? And I think that it turned out that neither was really the right answer, that what we eventually did was by this spirit of kindness that we showed in the Berlin Airlift.
Hmm. Yeah, Roosevelt, you quote him as saying that Germany would be best taught the ways of democracy at the point of a gun. And at another point, you quote him as saying, if I had my way, I would keep Germany in a breadline for the next 25 years. In other words, he was really concerned about Germany rising up again in yet another repeat of this pattern of violence. As it is, however, in the waning days of his life, you paint a picture of President Roosevelt as being utterly, really incapable of formulating far-reaching policy. And in a sense, his vision for what should be done with Germany is not fulfilled at all, and it really falls to his successor, President Truman, to ultimately shape the way in which we treated Germany.
That's right. You know, we, of course, hear a lot about, in the wake of Iraq, about the fact that we had planned for the war but not planned for the peace, and something similar happened in World War II. There had not been a great deal of planning about what would happen once we actually took over this enormous country in the heart of Europe. The initiative to do that had been in Franklin Roosevelt's hands, and he didn't want anybody else really taking that away from him. So he kept that responsibility for himself, didn't really delegate it to anybody else. But in those last years of his life, or in those last months especially, he was a dying man. He was really able to work only a few hours a day, maybe even a couple hours a day on some days, was tired, his heart was failing him, and really because of that, the entire administration was paralyzed, was unable to make some basic decisions about how we were going to treat Germany after we had occupied it. And so, of course, that decision then fell to, as you said, Harry Truman, and also to the general on the ground who became the military governor of Germany, General Lucius Clay.
Hmm. We don't have much time, but you should just talk, I think, briefly about his fascinating career, the fact that he was this general who actually spent so much of World War II behind a desk, and yet we read with great admiration about what probably the really crucial difference he made in our war effort, and then ultimately a great difference which he made in this whole situation in Berlin.
You read off a list of the main characters in the book earlier, and one of the things that unites them, and I think is very true for what you just said about General Clay, is that in some ways these were all people who were seen as history's second stringers, in the same way that Harry Truman was seen as a pale imitation of Franklin Roosevelt, especially when he was there and was seen as somebody who was not equal to the task. You had General Clay coming in after the great heroes of World War II, people like Eisenhower and Omar Bradley and General Marshall and others. And he was seen as really somebody who was not equal to the task. He had never faced combat, had been really desiring to be getting into the battles of World War II, and had, because of his enormous organizational abilities, been kept on the war front, first being in charge of the supply of the American forces, everything from pairs of pants to tanks that were needed to keep an army going, and then was in charge of making sure that things in the United States were running during wartime as well in our own economy. And he was then given the responsibility for running Germany, and nobody thought that anything involving military strategy would be involved or involving diplomacy. He was given the task because they thought it was really going to be just a job of being an administrator, of being a bureaucrat.
And he was a good one.
And he was a great one, but in fact, he had to use skills that nobody ever thought he had and that most people thought he didn't have. When it counted most at this very sensitive crisis, the closest we ever came to World War III, perhaps more so than even the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Hmm. And I that's an interesting characterization of those sort of second stringers of history for whom ticker tape parades are not given, and yet who figure so prominently, who in many cases make the crucial difference. We're speaking with Andre Cherny about his book, The Candy Bombers. I want to read a very striking portion of the book in which you describe Berlin at the end of World War II. Not since the pinnacle of Rome had one city ruled over so much of Europe. Never, not even when Rome was pillaged by barbarians, had a city fallen from such heights so quickly. And when Berlin's invaders came, it was not a civilization that was destroyed, but civilization itself, or at least its crude veneer, that vanished. Speak a moment more about Berlin at this moment in time, just ahead of the blockade, which of course plunges it into even further difficulty.
It's hard to remember, but as you said, you know, Berlin was one of the great cities of the world. It was, in area at least, the largest city in the world. And its people in the years before World War II began were among the most sophisticated. You had great artists and scientists like Albert Einstein living there, great place of culture and technology, more telephones there than any place else in the world. And the successive bombing of American planes and British planes, and then the Soviet invasion, the Russian invasion, all but leveled the city. 75% of its housing was uninhabitable. It was, when you looked at it, really just a city of a few kind of stubs of buildings left over, basically pockmarking a sea of debris. You had wolves roaming the street. It had become the crime capital of the world. Murders and robberies were very prevalent. And for the 3 years before the Berlin blockade, people were just barely surviving. Ration levels way below what the United Nations said was necessary to prevent starvation. People were really just trying to have the most meager of existence. And that was why everybody, both the Soviets as well as the Americans, thought that once that Berlin blockade went into place, the people of Berlin would quickly fold. They would return to their authoritarian roots that we talked about before. They would turn themselves over to the communists just so that they would not even fall into more despair. But one of the great parts of this story and why the airlift was so important was that it inspired them to keep going. And they took a stand against communism and for their own freedom. They demanded that they wouldn't have more food, which they would have had if the blockade had ended, that they would keep on being hungry in order to hold on to that measure of freedom that had been so hardly and so difficultly won for them.
I learned a lot in this book. One moment that I had never read about before was what occurred on July 20th of 1945. This was when President Truman went to the American sector of Berlin to officially raise the American flag in conquest over the German capital in a very brief ceremony, which, of course, could have been handled in any number of ways, and it could have unmistakably conveyed the message of you have lost and we are victorious. But the words that President Truman chose to speak on that occasion conveyed something else and were a source of hope for those Germans who heard some of what he said. Do you want me to just read a portion of that?
Sure, please.
Truman spoke without note, saying that they were there to raise the flag of victory over the capital of our greatest adversary, but we are not fighting for conquest. There is not one piece of territory or one thing of a monetary nature that we want out of this war. We want peace and prosperity for the world as a whole. We want to see the time come when we can do the things in peace that we have been able to do in war. That had to give great hope to the citizens of Berlin that that those kind of words were spoken in that moment by the conqueror to the conquered, so to speak.
Well, it was, and it was really a summation about the kind of faith that Americans had gone into the war with. They had been told by Franklin Roosevelt, and they believed that this was a very different kind of war, one about expanding justice in the world and about expanding a sense of hope and prosperity for people all over the world. And that was the kind of fighting faith of America during World War II. It was that vision that people like Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson had had before him and that Harry Truman was inheriting.
Of course, the situation begins to change dramatically as the Soviets begin exerting greater and greater influence, begin what ultimately leads to a full-fledged blockade, trapping, in effect, the citizens of Berlin, isolating them from the rest of the world, a tiny little dot in the midst of all kinds of territory which the Soviets had gained control over, and thus began the need for what became this airlift. I think for a lot of people of, for instance, this current generation looking back, they would not immediately understand what an incredibly difficult operation this was. I mean, it seems like a simple thing. Fly some airplanes over a city and just drop things down. Explain why this was such an exquisitely difficult undertaking.
Well, as I said before, this was the one of the largest cities in the world. And in the years after World War II, we had basically just decimated the American army and all our military strength. It was, of course, the years of bring the boys home, and we did. And we really just took apart the enormous army we had constructed to win World War II. We had literally blown up planes on the runways in Europe in order to save money so we wouldn't have to cart them up and bring them at home and put them in airplane graveyards. The planes that were necessary, the kind of cargo planes that we needed, we had only about 200 in the entire Air Force fleet in the world, and these were not the kinds of planes we see today. These were small, rickety planes, basically about the size of a school bus. And with these few small planes, we were able to not only feed the city for a year, feed them the millions of people there, but bring all the supplies that were needed to maintain their existence, the coal, every piece of clothing they needed, medicine, and so on. It's that kind of can-do spirit that I think so inspired people. You look at, of course, what happened a couple of years ago in New Orleans, and there was an American city, and we couldn't even bring supplies there. We couldn't even help the people there that needed help in that same way. This was 60 years ago, a very different world with a very different set of resources, and yet we were able to do that because we had that kind of spirit and that kind of leadership.
Hmm. One limitation to us was this primitive airport, Tempelhof, utilized in the early days of this airlift. Tell us about that.
It was the building itself was one of the largest buildings in the world. In fact, way into the 1970s, it was still the largest building in the world it was one of the largest buildings in the world. By the 1970s, it was the third largest. The only buildings that were larger were the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And it was situated right in the middle of Berlin. And the approach to it, however, was incredibly difficult. A pilot had to navigate past a smokestack on their left side, and on their right side, a six-story apartment building. And it was the runways were so short that they had to come in at an incredibly tight angle to clear both the apartment building and yet have enough room on the runway to land.
and it made it
even more difficult.
And one of the pilots was quoted as saying, when you landed on these primitive runways, it felt like a crop duster was landing in a cornfield. I mean, that's the kind of the rough ride.
Oh, sure. And a lot of these pilots, of course, had been the bombers during World War II, and a few of them would always remark about how they wish they had dropped a couple bombs on an apartment building back when they were bombing the rest of Berlin. So
right.
They'd have an easier time of it.
Yeah. Your book explains some of the fascinating logistical details about what was needed to make all of this work so well. You said it demanded constant creativity and improvisation. Every minute on the clock had to be part of the calculation. Every pound loaded onto these planes and exactly what kind of materials. I mean, this was not just about throwing boxes on a plane and flying them in. I mean, this became a highly sophisticated operation.
Well, it had to be. It was by the time that things really got underway there, a plane was landing and taking off every 3 minutes. So it was just a constant roar, and in order to make sure that you got enough supplies in, you had to be very careful about how you loaded up those planes. You could fill up the room on a plane with pasta or something lightweight like that, and you'd waste a lot of space, or you could fill it up with bags of coal, and you'd be too heavy. So you had to combine loads in order to get the optimum amount on each plane and make sure that it was still flyable. And it was an enormous logistical undertaking. One of the reasons people thought it couldn't work was because nobody could really figure it out. The one person in the world who thought that it could work was, in fact, the person they eventually put in charge of the airlift, Bill Tunner, who you mentioned earlier. And he was this logistical genius who was able to finally figure out how do you turn this operation into something that was haphazard and fly by the seat of your pants into something that was just a enormous assembly line.
The public face of this airlift was this kind-hearted and courageous American pilot by the name of Hal Halvorsen, who had an interesting moment of truth. Briefly describe that to our listeners, when he realized that there could be something else that could be part of this airlift that might make a tremendous difference for the children of Berlin.
He was where we get the title of the book, The Candy Bombers, from. He was an anonymous 27-year-old pilot. We mentioned him earlier before. And as I was saying, this was such a rigidly regimented operation. He'd always been a stickler for the rules, somebody who had made his career by always doing the right thing and was very much that mindset. But he, by accident, met some children along the fence of Tempelhof Airport, which we were just talking about, and he promised them on the spur of the moment that he would drop them some candy. These were, of course, the children 5, 6, 7 years old, whose only experience of America had been the country that had bombed them during the war and then occupied them in the years afterwards. And most of them at that age had never tasted chocolate before, never tasted a stick of gum or a piece of candy, had lived in this really terrible existence. And he said he would drop them some candy from his plane as he went over. This was, of course, very much against the rules. And yet he secretly did so. He tied some Hershey bars and Wrigley's gum to a handkerchief and dropped it out of his plane. He did it again, and he kept on doing it a few more times, and eventually the word got out, and thousands of Berlin children would show up at the airport to try to get one of these little handkerchief parachutes, and they started calling him the candy bomber. And this was the moment, really, that these children then fell in love with America, believed in us as a nation, and went home and convinced their parents of it, and it marked the turning point in the entire occupation.
Hmm. I had the great privilege of meeting a priest and musician who lives now in Hamburg, who remembers that airlift so vividly as a young man, and ever since has worked tirelessly to forge friendship between Americans and Germans, in his case, through music, by bringing his young musicians from his school over to America and welcoming American musicians to his country. And of course, this friend, acquaintance of mine, Pater Anselm, is just one in a sea of Germans who must have been so powerfully affected by this moment in history.
Well, Hal Halvorsen, who we were just discussing, he was 27 at the time, and now 60 years later on this 60th anniversary, he's 87 years old. He still has more energy than you and me combined and still flies his own plane, and he goes back to Germany a few times a year. I went back with him on one of his trips, and it was just amazing to see people in their 60s, 65, 66, who had been, of course, the children that had gotten the candy from the airlift or who had otherwise been saved by the airlift, and they would come up to him with tears in their eyes and tell him about what that little gesture meant to them in their lives, how it had inspired them, how it had given their hope, and how it really marked a sea change in how they viewed themselves and their really just horrible existence in Berlin. The idea that somewhere out there people believed in them, cared about them, they knew that people from all over America were sending in candy to be part of this effort, and it really changed their view of themselves, and it, of course, changed their view of America, and the dividends and the ripples of history are still being felt today.
Hmm. The book, again, is called The Candy Bombers, The Untold Story of the Berlin Airlift in America's Finest Hour, published by G.P. Putnam Sons, the author Andre Czerny. Mr. Czerny, I thank you so much for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you for having me on board.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, New York Times reporter Clay Risen talking about his newest book, and it's a beaut. It's called Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. And to fill out the hour, we will replay from 2021 my memorable conversation with bestselling author Larry Tye and his book called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. That is tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. From WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar, this Thursday evening, April 3rd, 7 p.m. at Founders Hall at historic Kemper Center, it is a special event. Turn your garden into the perfect B&B for birds, featuring Alice Berman, educator and owner of the Wild Bird Shack. If you would like more information about this, you should register for it through Eventbrite. Again, this event is free and open to the public, but you need to register for it. Our weather forecast calls for sunshine for most of the day, but a few clouds rolling in with a high today of just 43 degrees. Cloudy, windy, and rainy tonight. We might even see a rain-snow mix with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow, especially eventful, cloudy, windy, rainy, and maybe strong thunderstorms in the afternoon, a high of 69 degrees. By Thursday, sunshine should return with a high of 56 degrees, and we do expect mild conditions at least through Monday. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine, Elk.